Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads, generally, for most people, are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hello there, movie truthers. It's Michael Leader here, back once again with one of these remotely recorded lockdown specials of truth and movies. Today, we're actually talking about a new release for a change. Just in the couple of weeks before cinemas reopen again in the UK, there are still a couple of films going straight to digital that we wanted to shout out. And this week is actually the current cover film of Little White Lies. It is Minari. And talking about that film with me is Hannah Woodhead. Hannah, welcome to the show. I feel every time you're on the show recently, I need to ask where in the country you are and how the cat is doing.
I'm currently in London at my house, and Margot is doing great. She's just had her lunch, so she's having a nap. If there's any like bells in the background, it'll be Margot, just for listeners, because I know that on the Christmas episode, there was like the sound of like bells in the background, and it wasn't like a seasonal effect we added. It was just my cat like running around in the background. So yeah, if anyone hears that. But I'm glad you asked, because I'm actually going up north again next week for a few weeks to help out with family stuff. Mm-hmm. So I feel like the only person in the UK who's getting a change of scenery at the moment, even if it's just like moving from my house to my mum's sofa. Mm-hmm. But, you know, it pretty nice to see the countryside and help out the family amid all this coronavirus nonsense, which hopefully hopefully, fingers crossed, mm-hmm. toes crossed, about to get through.
Fingers crossed, we'll have to record another episode with you up there to make sure that we've always alternated between your flat and your family home.
I was thinking this must be like coming up to a year of these now. I can't remember when we did the first one, but
it would have been in March. So we started off with those sort of thematic episodes where we were talking about the future of cinema. These late night long chats that we had with Adam going through his vinyl collection. We also had Jason Wood talking about the situation in Manchester with Home. Gosh, that feels like so long ago, doesn't it? And we've tried to adapt and try to create normal episodes like we're doing today. But we're also joined, Hannah, by a new guest to Truth and Movies. I'd like to welcome Katie Goh. Katie, thank you for joining us today. Would you mind just telling our listeners who you are, what you do, where they might have read your stuff before?
Sure. Well, thank you very much for having me. I am a first-time caller, long-time listener of the podcast. My name's Katie. I'm a freelance film critic and journalist. You might have read some of my stuff in Little White Lies or ID or Vice or Dazed. And yeah, I think the last thing I did for Little White Lies was a review in the current Minari issue. That is a review of The World to Come, which is a film that I enjoyed very much, actually.
Mm-hmm. Terrific. And how's lockdown been for you? How's the last year been? You're based up in Scotland, right?
I am, but I'm calling from Belfast, actually, in Ireland. So I'm a bit like Hannah. I've been moving around a lot. So normally I'm in Edinburgh, but I'm at my parents' place right now because I got trapped after Christmas.
But now we're going to escape from our locked down lives and go to 1980s America to discuss this new release, Buzzy Award nominated release, Minari.
The Trial of the Chicago 7 is nominated for 6 Academy Awards, including Best Picture.
You know why you're on trial here?
3 BAFTA nominations, including Best Film and Golden Globe winner for Best Screenplay.
This is what revolution looks like, cultural revolution.
Deadline calls it the best film of the year.
So how do you overthrow your government peacefully?
In this country, we do it every 4 years.
The Trial of the Chicago 7, only on Netflix.
Now let's kick off, as I used to with new release segments, with a bit of a synopsis. It's going way back when. So, Minari. A tender and sweeping story about what roots us, Minari follows a Korean-American family that moves to an Arkansas farm in search of their own American dream. The family home changes completely with the arrival of their sly, foul-mouthed, but incredibly loving grandmother. Amidst the instability and challenges of this new life in the rugged Ozarks, Minari shows the undeniable resilience of family and what really makes a home. So, Minari's been a long time coming, it seems. It's finally out, 2nd of April in the UK. You can watch this at home at minari.film. But the buzz, the hype train has been rolling for nearly 18 months. It's up for 6 Oscars. It won the Grand Jury Prize and the Dramatic Audience Award at Sundance last year. And who was there in that first audience watching it at Sundance 2020 but Hannah Woodhead? Hannah, so Minari is this film that has become such a juggernaut in terms of the buzz and the hype and the discussion, but what was it like? What was your expectation going into watching it for the first time?
Yeah, I think with these films that start off at a festival, there's always that like, well, I knew right from the start it was going to go all the way. And, you know, people that were at the first screening of like Joker and Parasite and things. Actually, I was at the first screening of Parasite. But I think even then, like, maybe I'm just not very good at predicting these things, but I had no idea it would kind of have the momentum it's gained. And I'm very, very grateful that it has and very happy that it has, because it's so richly deserved. But there's always a worry when you watch a film at a festival that it is just going to kind of disappear into obscurity, especially somewhere like Sundance, where there's so many films and all kind of competing for attention. And this one didn't really, Minari didn't really have like a big starry cast. It obviously had Steven Yeun, but it wasn't, you know, something that I think everyone was super, super hyped for. It was kind of like, okay, this sounds interesting. Obviously, Lee Isaac Chung isn't a first-time filmmaker. He's been making films for a long time. This is his fifth feature, but really like his breakout in terms of, I think he would agree that it's, you know, unprecedented. And yeah, it was a very unexpected shock to watch this film and have the reaction I did. So I was in the premiere screening at the Library Theatre in Sundance, which is literally just, they have a library for the town, and during Sundance there's like a screening room, and it's very cosy and very cute. They make really good biscuits. And I was sat there about 4 rows from the front, and I think I started crying maybe 10 minutes in and just didn't stop the whole time. I was like completely like uplifted and devastated in equal measure, I would say. And it didn't really help that, like, I mentioned this in my first look review, maybe, I think, at the festival, but my grandma was diagnosed with cancer like 2 weeks before I went to the festival. So watching this film was like, oh my God, all my like feelings about family and my grandparents are really like, you know, being kind of brought up right now. And yeah, it was a very cathartic experience. And then to kind of watch this past year and a bit now has been really, really joyful for me as like someone who came out of that screening thinking, I hope everyone loves this as much as I do. To then like watch this kind of ripple around the world as more people see it and more people love it. It's been really nice. It's been like the greatest kind of joy as a critic, I think, is when you discover something and then watch other people kind of discover it and get to like have those conversations and recommend it to people. So yeah, I feel very like, I've been really enjoying watching the little Minari train travel around.
We should say that Sundance is a festival that occurs at high altitude. So sometimes the hype that when you're coming out of those screenings, you're already quite high on the lack of oxygen. So sometimes when those films do come out down the line, we're like, what were they thinking? But
yeah.
Thankfully, this seems to be different. Katie, you're sort of seeing it on a similar timeline to me, maybe months later after the hype was running. What was it like when you came to watch it?
Yeah, it was interesting because I saw the hype come out at Sundance, and I kind of had, you know, heard the synopsis, saw some of the first reviews, and I just knew like, oh yeah, this is gonna absolutely destroy me. And then the trailer came out, and I said, yes, it is absolutely going to destroy me, confirmed. And then, yeah, I finally watched it, and it did destroy me. So, you know, it's nice to be proven right for once by critics. But, yeah, it was really interesting to sort of see it build. I saw it around, maybe September, October last year. So it had, you know, it had, the hype was just sort of building, and it had been picked up by its distributors, and it was kind of, you know, the Oscars were coming sort of feeling about it. But yeah, I was absolutely blown away by it. On so many levels, I found it so impressive in terms of a craft level, the story itself, the acting, how it kind of felt like all of these perfect things have been brought together and create this really impressive film that is so confident, I think. And it's doing so much in terms of its the emotions it's playing with. It never feels like it's manipulating you, but it's, you know, it's, you know, it knows what it's doing. It's pulling at your heartstrings, but in a way that feels very genuine and lovely.
It's a really fascinating film, because I've been thinking about this when I've been talking about it, recommending it to people. You just see the poster image of a lad in the long grass with a nice kind of sunny background, and it's quite a hard one to really get a handle on, because unlike many of the Oscar-baity awards contention films, it doesn't have that central hook or dilemma or trauma at the centre of it. It's quite a poetic film, but as Lee Isaac Chung talks about, drawing so much from his own upbringing and his autobiography, yet it's not a sort of memoir, overcoming the odds kind of underdog story either. So can we home in on what is the heart of Minari when we're trying to recommend it to somebody? Maybe, Katie, when it destroyed you, what was it that was destroying you?
Many different things. I think that it's interesting you bring up the poster, because I think on that poster, and big white text in the middle of it says, this is a universal story or something like that. This is, you know, a story for everyone, which is obviously a huge marketing ploy by the distributors. But I think that, I mean, it's universal in terms of it's, you know, they're humans acting and we all relate as humans to other humans. But I think it's a very specific story, and that's why it's so good. It's so specifically a story about immigration, and specifically in that, Korean immigration. And it's a Korean-American story. And I think that, there's been a lot about how it's, you know, it's not focusing in too much on the sort of the immigrant experience. It's, you know, doing all these other things, which it is, but I think that the specifics are what really makes it work. There's some really beautiful moments in it. You know, there's a moment when Monica, the mother in the film, she her mother comes, the grandmother Sunja, and she brings, you know, chili powder and anchovies, which you can't get in America in the 80s, and she just starts to cry, and it's such a beautiful moment that anyone can relate to who has family overseas. But also it's very, you know, specific about her experience and about her experience as a Korean woman in America in a time when, you know, she was very cut off from everyone else. And I think that those specifics are really what gives the film so much of its heart and so much of its drive. And I think that in terms of, you know, why we would recommend a film like this, I think that you don't get that a lot in terms of big Oscar films. You don't really get films that are so careful, so carefully crafted. It's so obviously autobiographical, I think, and drawing on the Isaac Chung's experience, but it doesn't feel overly sentimental, I would say, as well, and it doesn't feel overly nostalgic. I would say it's more, yeah, retrospective, and it's very, it considers a lot of different things.
Yeah, for me, it is that, it's almost an interlocking. You talk very well there about the specificity of it, of the emotions and the experience, but it does work on these multiple levels for me, these interlocking levels. First of all, just the, I don't want to say novelty, but the uniqueness of the story. When we are used to a certain kind of immigrant story coming from America, usually they're urban, from the one of the coasts. This is a rural story. You know, they're trying to start up a farm. And also the setting of the early 1980s is not necessarily the era we associate with this sort of story. But then there's the poetic level. And Lee Isaac Chung spoke about this in interviews. Hannah, I know you've interviewed him, so maybe he said some of this to you, about how he'd made a few films and felt like he'd sort of not hit a brick wall, but come to a point where he had to change up how he worked. So, and wrote down all these memories, 80 memories or something from his upbringing that he wanted to put into a film, put on screen. So there is that specificity, but almost as a byproduct, there is this poetic level. So there's, of course, the title Minari, which is about a plant that almost survives and thrives in the worst circumstances where no other plants do, but also enriches the soil in the way that in the process of growing within it, which is almost a perfect positive, optimistic metaphor for immigration and what diverse communities can bring to a country. And the film has so many of those moments where you can see the specific, but then also this poetic level. And it's all centered around this family. Hannah, you interviewed Lee Isaac Chung and the cast members too. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, I mean, I was lucky enough to speak to Lee and Stephen Yeun and Alan Kim, who were all so generous and insightful and so kind of excited to talk about the film. And, you know, obviously when you interview someone about their work, they're usually going to be kind of excited. But I think it felt especially nice to do so kind of, this would have been just before Christmas. So I think it was a really sort of, it was the period where I guess everyone realised kind of this film is probably going to go all the way. I think there's always a bit of, sometimes it's so early in the year, it takes a lot for a film to be able to maintain that momentum and kind of get all the way to the Oscars. It doesn't happen that often. I think maybe like Get Out and Call Me By Your Name are the only two like kind of recent examples I can think of. And now obviously the film stands like quite a good chance of picking up a number of awards. So I would very much hope so anyway. But yeah, speaking to them was a really like delightful experience, especially talking to Lee about the film and kind of where it came from. Because I think there's always such a narrative in Hollywood around like filmmaking that is like, they're always looking for the kind of the next hot young thing. And there's a sort of trajectory now that we all joke about where, you know, you make your debut feature and it's like a breakout indie film that maybe gets a Sundance Grand Jury Prize and then you go make a Marvel movie. And it was kind of refreshing to hear from this guy who's been making films for a number of decades now. He's taught film kind of all around the world. He worked in Rwanda with his wife for a long time. And this was kind of his make or break moment where he decided if he couldn't do filmmaking forever, then he was going to make a film that meant the most to him. And obviously that was about his family. And just kind of hearing someone talk about the experience of like laying everything out on the page and then, you know, bringing that to the screen, you feel very privileged because it's a hard thing to do. It's, you know, it's hard to open yourself up to people in that way and kind of wait for their reactions. You know, what if they hate it? What if they basically say your whole life is garbage, you know? So, you know, kind of talking to him about that was really interesting. But also his reactions from his family about the film were fascinating because he said there were certain things he put into the film just as like, you know, kind of fictional flourishes, and his family would come back and say, oh yeah, I remember that. And he's like, no, you don't, because it didn't happen, which I thought was really funny and also kind of says something about like the way memory is. I think that there are things you kind of invent just to like make sense of your past a lot of the time, especially when your family's kind of been through traumatic experiences. And I think watching the film, there is kind of evidence that it wasn't all, you know, plain sailing. It wasn't this great American dream style situation where they went out to Arkansas and made a wonderful farm with inherent prosperity. I think the thing that I love so much about the film is that it is, there's so much kind of nuance between the good things and the bad things that exist in this new life they forged for themselves. And talking to Stephen Yeun as well, he talks a lot about how it's not just kind of a story of immigrants from Korea kind of coming to America to make a new life, but also that idea of moving from the big city and the coast to the rural life and kind of all the little like discrepancies that you find. It's something that his family did as well when they moved. I think they moved from the opposite way, so it was from like Canada to I want to say Michigan. I think that he's from Detroit. And he said, you know, it's another kind of culture shock. And I think we see that in the film as well. You know, the kids especially seem kind of a little bit dumbfounded by this like strange rural community they've been forced into. And I love the bit where David goes over to his friend's house and his little friend is like showing him all his like dad's like guns or something that he's showing him, and it's so clearly far removed from like from David's experience and David's life. And the other great scene that has divided people, I know that some people really didn't like this, was with Paul, who's kind of this handyman on the farm and kind of like imposes himself on the family, but in a sort of sweet way. And he's one day they're driving back from church, the family, and they see Paul on the side of the road wheeling this like giant wooden cross on his back. And it's a very literal kind of like everyone's got their cross to bear moment. But I was talking to Lee about this, and he said, yeah, that's completely true. That there was a guy who did that in my hometown. He was really nice. we all knew every Sunday he'd be out there wheeling his giant cross around. So I think it's interesting, like watching a film based on someone's experience and kind of wondering yourself how much is true and how much is kind of manufactured for the screen. And then obviously doing these interviews, I was like, oh wow, like the things that I kind of thought that there's no way that can be true is completely 100% genuine. And I think it's so, like Katie said, you know, getting kind of something that's so specific to someone's experience is so rare with awards films. I think we're so used to seeing this very glossy, very slick world in the kind of the things that usually get awards and awards buzz. But this does feel like there is something kind of a little bit rough hewn about it that I really like. It feels so authentic and so affectionate. Mm-hmm. It's, you know, it's everything is so kind of beautifully realized. I think it's a very it would be hard for me to talk about my family with as much nuance as Lee Isaac Chung does. I think he articulates kind of his parents as human beings so beautifully.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am, but Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
I think nuance is the word, and Katie, you used that as well. The tone of this is quite unique. You mentioned the other characters in their orbit, like Paul, and their view of the little town, or at least the film's view of the little town, at times makes me think of almost a lightly Coen Brothers-esque small town America. They're ever so slightly caricatured, but in a loving way. But then that also speaks to the tone of the film in the way that both on the festival art house and the Oscar bait ends of the spectrum, this story could be pushed towards peril or conflict or trauma. Lee Isaac Chung makes that really interesting decision to almost keep that stuff to the sides. I think he says in interviews that when he was a kid, like he's almost, his insert character here would be David, the boy. He just was just surviving on a daily basis, not to be embarrassed, you know, by his grandma or whatever. he wasn't thinking about it on the level that if we compared this with something like a Small Axe series, which is very much a political, big political series of films. And now, Katie, what did you make of that decision and what that brought to the film and made it different, made it better?
Yeah, it's interesting. I think that in terms of the perspective, I think that's a really interesting balancing act because, yeah, it's autobiographical and he's basically, you know, David's point of view for a lot of it. But then the point of view changes a lot. It changes to Jacob's as well. And I think Liazek Chung has talked a lot about how, as he's gotten older, as he's had his own children, that he understands his parents better and he understands what the character of Jacob is doing, who would have been his sort of, you know, father figure. And I think that the film maybe is able to balance so much because it's balancing perspective in such a, yeah, I mean, I feel like we keep saying nuance, but it really is. It's such a testament to how good the filmmaking is, I think, and the writing is that, yeah, he's balancing these perspectives. He's balancing not only a child's perspective and an adult's perspective, but then also a grandmother's perspective. Mm-hmm. He's balancing a foreign perspective on America and then, you know, also an American's perspective on these foreigners who have come in. You see that with, you know, some of the American characters too. And then also balancing the children are, I think, Korean-American children. The parents are Korean immigrants, which is also a very different sort of, you know, strife. And I think that the film is so successful because all these competing tensions, it's why the film feels so textured, I think, as well as, you know, the beautiful cinematography and the music, which is incredible as well, that the film feels, I think, authentic in that way, not just because it has inspired by the director's true life story on it, but also because it doesn't feel whitewashed in any way in terms of, you know, it doesn't feel sanitized in any way. It feels quite messy, which I think, yeah, some people might not like as much, maybe. I've seen some criticism of the film that it doesn't, you know, satisfy people in some ways, which I think is quite interesting. It doesn't maybe have that the arc for some people, which I think, yeah, I find that completely the opposite. I think it's a really wonderfully structured film in terms of it's such a slow build, and then there is this huge, you know, set piece at the end that kind of this huge moment of catharsis for the characters and the audience. So, yeah, I think that, yeah, like I was saying, all of these competing things do bring a real sense of authenticity to it.
It's also, because of all of those balanced perspectives, probably more of an ensemble movie than some people may realise. And so we could really take our pick about any of the actors if we want to start throwing praise in their direction. So, Katie, who do you want to start with out of the cast?
All right, my MVP of Minari today is Han Yi-ri, I think.
Right.
He plays Monica, the mother and wife. Yeah, she's not getting enough love, I don't think, from people. She is absolutely the, you know, heart of this family in a lot of ways. She grinds it. She brings, you know, so much love to the film, I think. You know, she's dealing with her husband's, you know, kind of crazy dream of creating this farm on this land that, you know, the previous owner killed himself because he couldn't make it work. So she's having to deal with that and the move to this place. She doesn't know anyone. She's isolated from everyone. She's having to look after her son David, who has a heart murmur. And she's just kind of, yeah, so there's a lot going on for her, but I think that Han Yi-ri's performance is really, really powerful and really, really, yeah, I think it's interesting. I don't want to give any spoilers, so I find it quite difficult to talk about it, but the final big sort of climax of the film, and you see her finally break, and it's such a beautiful moment because it's not Jacob who breaks, it's her who breaks, because she has put everything onto this family to succeed, and, you know, she's sacrificed pretty much everything for her husband's dreams, and then whenever it kind of all goes up in smoke, she's kind of sort of left and, you know, trying to keep this family together. So, yeah, I think that I think about her performance the most, I think, actually, out of everyone in the film.
That's I'm really glad you brought her up, because she is somebody who's getting less love. particularly with awards nominations and attention. But she just carries so much of the film and is central to one of the key tensions within the family, which is between the solid dad figure whose ambition is tangled up in his responsibility towards his family. So he is going to try and make this farm work because he has a dream for the family in the future. But of course, his ego is also tied up in that as a man. And so Monica, the mother character, has to weather that. And the somewhat trendy term would be emotional labor versus the hard labor of actually digging the trenches for the farm. But it's a really important part of that. And I mean, I want to shout out Stephen Yeun. We've mentioned him on the podcast before because he was amazing in Burning a couple of years ago. I think at the time I said that his performance in Burning was one where once you see him on screen, you immediately want to punch him. But a very different character in that film because he's a slick city boy that you're meant to hate. Whereas in this, he is blue jeans, white t-shirt, red baseball cap. He is Bruce Springsteen. He is, at least he is trying to be. But again, has that in very knotted kind of role to perform of wanting to project a masculinity, almost hitting his head against the wall of a country or the literal land that doesn't want to bend to his will, and how that personality, that ego is affected by that. And it's such a great breakout role for him. He's been, of course, in terms of telly and stuff with The Walking Dead, he's been on our screens for years, but is between a couple of key Korean films like Burning and Okja, and then I suppose Sorry to Bother You a couple of years ago as well. He's now slowly making his way into the A-list, or we hope so. You're a Stephen fan, aren't you, Hannah?
Yeah, big time. I watched most of The Walking Dead. I think I probably finished, I gave up on it after Stephen Yeun left, actually. Just kind of, it's when it really got bad for me, which maybe is because of Stephen leaving it. I think he was so great on that show, which was a very a mixed bag if ever there was one. And yeah, he's an actor that I think has been consistently doing the work when he's given opportunities, but he does seem like someone who has been overlooked time and time again by Hollywood. And I think a lot of that is probably down to the kind of intrinsic racism and also this very strange relationship Hollywood has with Asian and Asian American actors, where they oftentimes kind of do cast them in these very like caricatured roles. And I think that Stephen Yeun is someone who's always done his level best to avoid any of those roles, which is great, but must be so frustrating for him when, you know, he's such a talented performer and to not be given those opportunities. But finally, it seems like the world is kind of catching up with audiences who I think have always kind of known that he's great at whatever he does. And the thing I love about him as a performer is he has all these layers to him, and he can go from kind of being this goofy guy in Okja or Sorry to Bother You, or in his one scene role in I Think You Should Leave, which is the comedy sketch show on Netflix. He's in the very first episode of the final sketch. If you want to check that out, I would highly recommend it. He has a great sense of comedic timing, and I believe he actually did kind of train in like improv and comedy acting before kind of moving into dramatic acting. So I would love to see him as like a, you know, flat out like romantic comedy lead. I think he would crush it. I think he'd be so good. But then there's also this like sensibility, which we see in Burning and we see in Minari, where he is very good at kind of, how would you describe this? Giving that impression of a man who is holding a lot back and could kind of explode at any moment. And I think we see more of that in Minari than we did in Burning, certainly, because there's just more of him in Minari. In Burning, I think the thing that's fascinating is like I still to this day have conversations with people where we can't decide if he did it or not. And I was talking to a friend of the podcast, Jake Cunningham, about this, and he is very firmly in the he didn't do it camp, and I'm in the he absolutely did it camp. But, you know, that film came out, what, 2-3 years ago, and the fact we're still, like, debating that is very, very kind of testament to how good that film is and how great he is in it. But yeah, it's so good to see him get this really meaty role where he gets to kind of be channeling James Dean and that kind of like very raw ideal of like the what it means to be a man and kind of what it means to look after a family and like provide for your family. We talked a lot about James Dean when I spoke to the Isaac Chung and when I spoke to Stephen, because they both used him as kind of like a model, and specifically like East of Eden for Minari and kind of what they wanted to portray. And I think that's such an interesting model because it's not something that a lot of people would associate with an immigrant story. We think of James Dean as like the ideal of like all American, you know, kind of excellence, I guess. And I was really like really interested to hear that he'd been this model. And I think you definitely see that kind of same intensity. And it's from, I mean, I'm very glad that Stephen Yeun seems to have such a like head on his shoulders. He seems very like very focused and very like not only a wonderful actor, but so kind of like in it. He's so like, you know, he thinks so deeply about his roles and about like the craft of acting. And it's clear that like it means a lot to him. His role in this film means a lot. And I think he's so remarkable, and his chemistry with Alan Kim as well, like the way they interact together. And kids, like, you know, kids in films can either kind of make it or break it, but Alan Kim, like this being his first role, just what a tiny superstar. And when you watch him in interviews, he's absolutely nothing like this character. He's so like kind of like chatty and like mischievous and, you know, very very eloquent, and I am kind of like blown away by how good he is in this film. I think it's so impressive to be that good that young.
Are you a member of the Alan Kim fan club, Katie?
Oh yeah, big time. Because I think that whenever you maybe first see the trailer for the film, you think that it's going to be, like I did, absolutely devastating, which, you know, it is. But it's also very funny. There's so much humour in it that comes from the interactions between Alan Kim's character David and Sunja, his grandma. You know, he absolutely hates his grandmother for, you know, most of the film, and he says she smells like Korea, and, you know, there's a lot of going on there. But there's this brilliant moment where he hands her a drink of what you think is Mountain Dew, but it turns out not to be Mountain Dew, and, you know, it's absolutely brilliant. And yeah, it's I think that sometimes its humour maybe gets overlooked, and, you know, there's absolutely great comedic performances here as well as, you know, great dramatic ones too.
Oh, I think that Yoon Yeo-jung, who plays the grandmother, her performance is astonishing. She's somebody who, in terms of Korean cinema, has a career dating back all the way to the 60s. But in terms of maybe, you know, us in the English-speaking world, maybe this might maybe our introduction to her. And she is brilliant in a primarily comedic performance at times as well. That she is this, you know, what the gift she gets out of her bag immediately for the kids is like a pack of cards, right? Because she wants to teach them how to be good at cards and gamble. So she's not the traditional grandma, and that, you know, keys into one of those themes that for the two kids who've grown up in America, they have a very particular cultural image in their head of what a grandma is, and she very much isn't. But even within that, you know, unlikely grandma performance, there is such emotional depth, particularly with the relationship that grows between her and the boy David. But yeah, the comedy is something, Katie, you're right to pick it up. When I rewatched this film, I picked up a sort of ironic thread that's almost there from the very beginning, when they first get to the farm, and I think it's in dialogue between Jacob and Monica that where she's saying, "Really want to come here?" And Jacob's like holding a handful of dirt, and he says, "This is the best dirt in America," which, I don't know, maybe that's just me with a particularly cynical sense of humor, but that just feels like, you know, there's a sense of irony there. But it also is a route into what is so quietly profound about this movie. You know, Hannah, you said that we're surprised that somebody as all-American as James Dean could be an influence on this, on the performance for Stephen Yeun as Jacob. But what is more American than this story? About this sort of new frontier spirit, the trying to commune with the land, have a patch of your own, 50 acres of your own. That is the sort of quietly profound but hits like a freight train kind of theme, right? That this is a version of the American dream, whether they are pursuing it and whether they achieve it or not. That's something, there's something very pure about that.
Yeah, I also think that it's so clever, though, because it also completely blows up the American dream, and it sort of shows just how hollow it is. And it's, again, like all these competing tensions in this film is what makes it so good, because it absolutely is about pursuing this idea that Jacob has, but he's also within that, he, you know, dismisses Paul's help to sort of find the water off this land, because he thinks, he's like, Koreans use their heads, they don't use, you know, and he wants to create a farm full of Korean products, not American products, to sell to the local community. So yeah, again, there's this tension between, you know, farming and that sort of labor, and that, you know, James Dean spirit is, you know, the American dream, but at the same time it's kind of this spin on what we're used to, I think, which makes it, yeah, really, really a fascinating portrayal of that, and how, you know, it does feel like the American dream almost betrays Jacob in the film as well. Whenever you see how it plays out for him and the family, it almost destroys the entire family.
It's such a different spin, because you think about other genres that put a spin on what the American dream means, particularly immigrant stories like a Godfather or a Scarface or Once Upon a Time in America. Mm. It's often that is the American dream curdling into something else. But this, it's through a pure pursuit of the American dream that you discover that it's falsity in this film. It's really fascinating. So Katie, this is your first time on the podcast, so I'm going to put you on the spot here with putting scores on the film. So in the tried and tested Little White Lies fashion, we have an in anticipation, enjoyment, and in retrospect score out of 5. And could you have a bash at that for us?
Yeah, I'm going all 5. Uh-huh. 5, 5, 5. Let's go. Yeah, I think that, I mean, to be honest, Lee Isaac Chung is not a director I'm overly familiar with. I was aware of some of his work, and particularly his documentary. But I think just coming out of Sundance, the hype was, it was real, and I was worried it wouldn't live up to it. But yeah, I absolutely love this film. It's my favourite film I've seen recently, and I think that I'm also worried because I don't want to hype it up too much, you know, and then disappoint other people. But I think that, yeah, I think if you go into it with an open mind and an open heart, I think that you'll find a really nuanced, lovely portrait of what it is to sort of, yeah, be a human being, regardless of, you know, who you are or what your stance is in life. I think that's, you know, what makes it so great.
That's beautifully put. Hannah?
I'm going to go 4, 5, 5, just because my anticipation was, you know, I didn't really know anything about the film going in at Sundance. But yeah, definitely it's one I've not really stopped thinking about. And as someone with a very short attention span, for that kind of hype to last for over a year for me is pretty rare. And I really think we've become so jaded, I think, over the past year. We've seen kind of the worst of humanity and, you know, people really, just when you think in the middle of a pandemic, like, people can't sink any lower, they continue to surprise and amaze us with ways they can. So to watch a film like this, which is really about how humans come together in times of crisis, or can come together in times of crisis, and kind of work in pursuit of each other's, like, comfort, and not necessarily like a greater good in a grand noble context, but just in the kind of context of, like, family and acting, you know, acts of love that we do for one another, like bringing over groceries from Korea, or, you know, teaching someone to play, like, your favorite game. All these little kind of things we see throughout the film, which just, like, remind you kind of how special family is, whether it's like your, you know, your birth family or family you've kind of found for yourself. And I think it's just such a tonic in these kind of still fraught times. I think it really is a very special film, and I feel very protective over it.
Yeah, it'll definitely make you want to call your grandma if you're lucky enough to, you know, still have your grandma with you.
I don't want to seem like I'm undermining those fives by saying I'll give this 4-4-4, but I will give a reason for that. I think that it is a film that has, and it clearly did with both of you, it can be really devastating and really take hold of you emotionally. However, because it has a very specific and understated way about it, you could miss, if you just missed that thread, that you could miss the film. And seeing it on the small screen, I'm really feeling very strongly this year about watching some of these big awards contenders, best films of the year, on at home, on my telly or on a laptop. They're not hitting me in the way that I know a big screen experience would be. So this is a 4-4-4 with an expectation that if I can get back in the cinema, this might graduate up. But it is really worth seeing right now because it is one of the best films of the last, however long it has been, Hannah, 16 months since it premiered. But
I'd go even longer. I think it's, you know, in terms of like American cinema, I think it's like one of the best. You know, when we do our end of the decade list in 9 years' time, I would expect this to make people's lists. I think it's, you know, it is going to stand the test of time. Something so, this thing I talked about with Lee, like the more specific you go with a story, often the kind of wider it ends up opening up. It's a very strange like irony that then the more, you know, the deeper you get into your experience, the more likely it is people will kind of find something to relate to or something that grabs them. And I think that because this is set in the past, it does kind of, it's not going to age in the way that I think a lot of films might. So yeah, I again would say people should watch it as soon as it comes out. But also I'm very hopeful that cinemas will give it a second run when we get back open. Cause it does, I think just being in the dark, like just kind of enveloped by this film is what really makes it feels like a hug, you know, a no contact hug.
I'm just putting a reminder in my phone for 2029 November. Remind Hannah, Minari needs to be in end of decade.
I'm sure it will.
If we still have films then. Everything will be a Disney Plus.
God.
But anyway, that is Minari, which is available to rent at minari.film from 2nd of April. We all strongly recommend you check it out. And also, if you want to afterwards, check out the new issue of Little White Lies. You can find out how to order that at lwlies.com. However, before we sign off, let's open things up a little bit. We've just focused on one film this week, so let's give some quick fire recommendations of what we've been watching that maybe people can go and check out if they have seen Minari or aren't interested. Katie, new guest goes first. What have you been watching and enjoying that you think could brighten our lives right now?
Well, I haven't been watching a lot of films, to be honest, because I don't know, there's something with my attention span at the moment that just, I find the idea of sitting down to watch a 2-hour film quite overwhelming right now. But what I have discovered is how great The Great Pottery Throwdown is. I think it's been on for a few years now, but I never watched it, and yeah, it's just brilliant. It's just watching a bunch of randoms just trying to make some pots, and sometimes they work, sometimes they don't. The stakes are very, very low, but also at the same time very, very high because it's pottery. So I'd highly recommend that if you want, so yeah, something to sort of escape to because the stakes are so low, Great Pottery Throwdown.
I haven't watched any of it, but I hear there's somebody who is so into pots that they cry nearly every episode.
Yeah, that's the judge. He gets so emotional about lines that he just will sometimes burst into tears. He'll hold up a pot and just start crying, which, I mean, highly relatable after watching Great Pottery Throwdown. I really am walking around my house now, picking up pots, weeping at their lines. Yeah, it's brilliant. It's, yeah, just very comforting, very wholesome TV.
Mm-hmm. Hannah, what have you been watching?
Not comforting or wholesome in any way, shape or form, but I have been steadily working my way through The Sopranos over the past 4 months. I'm now about 15 episodes from the end, and it's going to be like a death in the family when I get to the end of it. I don't know what I'm going to do with myself. But yeah, I mean, I'm very late to the course, but then I was 8 when it started airing. So everyone keeps asking me, why are you only just watching it? I'm like, I was 8. Like, what do you want from me? But yeah, no, it turns out it's pretty good. as everyone said, it was very, very funny. I hadn't kind of prepared myself for how deeply funny the show is, very slapstick at times, and lots of good movie chat. All the Sopranos are movie heads and never shut up about films, and that I really love. There's kind of all these weird little like tangents it goes off into about like movies that you just don't expect from a show about the mafia in New Jersey, and yeah, I there's lots of it, so you know, if you're looking for a project, I'd highly recommend. And yeah, go over on Twitter and at me with your favourite Sopranos moments, because one of the great joys has been talking to people about it. It's a show that has such a kind of rich history. And if you start now, you'll be all caught up in time for the prequel film that's coming out in September.
Excellent. I don't really watch much telly, as I said before on this podcast, so The Sopranos completely passed me by. Maybe I'll go back and watch it. That sounds like a good, strong enough recommendation. But one TV series I have been watching, and this brings us back into the wholesome sort of area, is a series that's just, is an animated series that's just launched on Netflix called City of Ghosts. And it's absolutely wonderful. It's a kids show, but I've got to query whether kids would really like it. I hope kids would like it. It's about a group of kids in Los Angeles who form the Ghost Club, and they go and investigate various hauntings around town. And in the process, they explore various neighborhoods of LA, and the ghosts represent various communities or residents who maybe have been whitewashed, gentrified, or generally sidelined in the history of Los Angeles. So it's got real bite to it, but it's told in such a wonderful, light way, and you get to learn so much. And I would not have expected from an animated Netflix series to be getting my like dose of psychogeography. And after a year where I live a couple of miles out of London, but we've been locked down and I've been unable to like walk around the big city I love so much, it's so nice to be able to be transported to another city and get a real wonderful taste of it. I'd really recommend that. A City of Ghosts. So not the BAFTA-nominated documentary from a couple of years ago, and not the Matt Dillon thriller from 2011 or whatever it was, but City of Ghosts. I'd recommend that. So listeners, that's plenty of recommendations for you to go away and watch. You could let us know what you think of Minari or any of the other recommendations we've just given you at the usual channels. That's at LWLies on Twitter, truthandmovies@tcolondon.com via email, or at the comments section at lwlies.com/podcast. We should be back with another one of these film-specific episodes very shortly. But for now, thank you, Hannah. Thank you, Katie.
Thank you.
Thanks.
I'm Michael Leader, and thank you for listening.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight, and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford Tough, Built Ford Proud.